You're listening to a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, dedicated to bringing podcasters together for the greater good of gaming. It's sort of like Voltron, but with better lip syncing. Find out more at dicetowernetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 254.
Hello everybody, we are here and super excited for a show. You know why we're excited for a show? Because we went on vacation and we are back and we played a bunch of games and I'm excited to talk about them.
And you have energy because there haven't been children?
Yeah, all of our kids are at camp this week. It's quiet in the morning. I can have my coffee in peace. It's fantastic.
I'm not a morning person, and I actually have time to, like, get myself going.
We are the Family Gamers. I'm your host, Andrew, and I'm joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
And we love our children. We also really like the quiet.
I really do.
Yeah.
I miss them, though.
I do. Well, we'll pick them up tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, as it, you know, happens, as I like to do, I have a fact about the number 254, the episode number of this podcast.
All right.
You ready for it?
I am.
Okay. So I think the first time I ever heard about over-the-air updates for cars was with Tesla.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Right. Does that sound? Yeah. I had never heard about it before, but NVIDIA, the company NVIDIA, they make graphics cards and stuff. They're releasing a chip that is supposed to make its way into consumer cars next year, although I don't know what the shortages and all this stuff, but I don't know. It's called the Orin chip, O-R-I-N. The Orin chip can complete 254 trillion operations per second.
Whoa.
That's a lot of operations.
That is a lot. A lot of operations.
According to NVIDIA, all that power will allow automakers to build software-defined vehicles that they'll be able to upgrade in perpetuity with the help of over-the-air updates.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah.
Could be good, could be terrible. Only time.
Now, the interesting thing about that is they're also planning for in 2025, so I don't know when people are listening to this, but it's currently 2021, so the Orin will be out in 2022. They are planning on releasing, by 2025, the Atlan chip, A-T-L-A-N, which will be able to complete 1,000 trillion operations per second.
What?
1 quadrillion, I believe.
What? Yeah.
I don't know why it says 1,000 trillion. Wouldn't they just call it 1 quadrillion? But maybe quadrillion's not the right thing. I feel like you're getting into the point where you're like making up like Googleplex kind of numbers at that point.
I think you just need to use scientific notation.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. But the point is, the Orin chip, available in cars in 2022, can complete 254 trillion operations per second. Cool. And that's a lot. And that is my fact about the number 254.
All right.
We'd also like to remind our listeners that the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial.
How do you dig out of debt? The honest answer is slowly and painfully. There is no quick magic solution, and anyone who says otherwise is selling you something. There are companies out there who offer to lower your payments and help you settle your debts. Beware. What most of these companies do is have you start making your reduced monthly payment to them, but they don't turn around and pay your debts. Instead, they wait. After a few months of your bills going unpaid, you'll get a call from a collections agent and you're supposed to tell them to talk to your settlement company. The two companies then haggle over how much of your debt will be repaid, if any, and if you're working with a reputable company, they get the debt settled and written off so collectors don't keep coming around. From that point, which sometimes takes a year or two, you will have to deal with 7 years of ruined credit, which makes this really only slightly better than going through bankruptcy. Another better option, if you can manage it, is to use a credit counselor. All the things the debt settlement company did are things you can do. So the credit counselor walks you through those steps, like calling your creditors to negotiate a payoff plan with lower payments. These credit counselors often cost around $50 a month, but the process they walk you through to pay off your debts will build your credit throughout the process, so when you come out the other side, you have a good credit score. First Move Financial is not a credit counseling company, but they'd be happy to spend a few minutes talking to you to help you find a reputable credit counselor. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers to set up a quick chat and start taking steps to dig out of debt.
Thank you so much to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the show.
So, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, you know, we, like I said, we were on vacation and we were kind of thinking about like what kind of fun things could we talk about. And of course, this game Trails recently came out. This is from Keymaster Games. They made Parks. It's part of the Parks series.
All over the internet, right?
All over the internet. And we were talking about games that are smaller versions of other games.
Yeah, ones that have been kind of sized down for portability, sometimes more often for a faster and simpler experience.
And sometimes they just cost less money and things like that, you know. And so we thought that we would take, you know, an episode to talk about games that are made more compact and some games that we like the smaller version of. Some games, there are some games out there where we've tried the smaller version and we actually prefer the larger version, even if the smaller version is like supposed to be the two-player version. We actually prefer the larger one at two players. So we're going to take a couple of these titles in the second half of the show and we'll just talk about them and you know, share our thoughts.
All right. Well, so that's the second half. In the first half, let's talk about what we've been playing.
What? We're going to talk about what we've been playing?
Well, the first thing we've been playing is Trails, because right. We did go out and buy a copy after we decided this would be the topic of the show.
For research.
For research purposes.
So we'll talk about Trails, second half of the show. In fact, you know what? I will make a commitment that it will be the first smaller game that we'll talk about. How's that?
Okay. All right. Sounds fair.
Next game is Robots Ate Our Pizza. You've been playing this a lot with the kids. Finally, I got a chance to play this game. I think that what you said about this game is exactly spot on. This is to Set Collection what The Crew is to trick-taking games.
Yeah, Set Collection and drafting. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at what's in your hand and saying, what should I give and what should I hope comes back around to me?
Right, yeah. And it's a really, really interesting game that I enjoy playing. Nice small box game. Pretty fun. I like it.
The theme is very cute, too. You're trying to make these sets and beat a certain score, and the better you do, the fewer pieces of pizza the robots eat.
Right. And we also went out for pizza, just you and me, and it was pretty good.
That was pretty good, too.
Yeah, so I'm glad the robots didn't eat it.
Yeah. I pulled you in to play a game of Tumbletown from Weird Giraffe Games.
It's fine. You know, there's a lot in this game that reminds me of Wingspan.
At first, when you mentioned this to me, I couldn't see it, but the more you talked it over with me, the more I saw it.
Yeah, so in this game, you are drawing these cards, which are buildings, and those buildings, in order to actually build those buildings, you have to draft dice that are certain die values, and then you spend those dice to physically build the building on your little street map that you have in front of you, and that whole process of drafting dice, like that's essentially drafting the food in Wingspan, right? Yeah. Except in Tumbletown, you actually have physical dice. And then you're drafting these buildings to fit them on your street in ways that are going to get you bonus points. But in reality, you're building an engine.
Yes, because a lot of the buildings have special powers to them. Some of them are one-time use that as soon as you build them, you get some special bonus. Some of them are, you can use them once per turn, and so you can do it over and over again. And then there's a third group that's all bonus point focused. So those buildings are harder to build, but they can give you some direction to say, hey, build this building, and then you want to do a lot of this kind of building afterwards.
And for more all bonus. Of that is the kind of thing you see in Wingspan with the different kinds of birds. And so I just saw a lot of similarities there. I mean, there definitely is a little bit of like a 3D kind of puzzle thing going on with the street and stuff. So that's a little bit different. But at the end of the day, I really felt like the itches that this game scratched are the same ones that Wingspan scratches. And it's Wingspan.
I think I like Tumbletown a little better than you do. Maybe some of that is the physical puzzle nature of it, but it bothers me how much time it takes to set it up.
Yeah, there is a kind of a lot of overhead in getting everything going. I would like to play this game at a higher player count to really get a feeling for how it is in its, you know, in its fullest potential.
Sure.
But like a lot of while I was playing, I was like trying to understand how certain pieces of the game worked. And like, all I could think the whole time was, man, that Wingspan Quick Start Guide is so helpful.
Yeah.
To, I mean, because it is, and it's a brilliant addition to, you know, a very good game already. And I was just like, I want something like that for this game. And then the more I played the game, I was like, you know why I want it for this game is because this game reminds me of Wingspan so much, even though the theme is completely different. The road is completely different. It's got that 3D puzzle element, which I do really, really like. But I don't know.
It's a real slow start, and it's a little bit tough to explain. I do not blame the people who made the how to play video. I don't normally watch them, but I watched this one. And it took until my second time through to realize that, hey, you actually do physically build these buildings with the dice, because they don't even tell you that in the video. They just kind of show some off to the side.
Yeah, that's not great.
It's not great.
Right. I mean, I almost think, like, mechanically the game is fine, and I don't think this game is unbalanced or anything like that. We had a really good time playing. We had a fairly close score. I'm pretty sure you won, but we had a pretty close score. A lot of the kind of standard complaints that I have with a game, like, a lot of the time I'll be like, you know what, this game is good, but it needed to go through one more round of development kind of thing. I don't feel that way about this game. However, I do feel like this game could have benefited from another round of polish.
Yeah, it just a little slow and a little bit tough to teach.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, and it comes with a dice tower in the box. Like, I will say that, like, the box is the perfect size. I know people laugh at me because I talk about box size a lot. You would think that it's not an important thing, but for me it is. The box for this is, like, the perfect size. Like, everything fits, but it's not a puzzle to get it all in there. But it came with a dice tower that is just not great. Like, I broke it trying to put it together. Like, it's just how I feel about it. Like, I didn't not like it. I did like it, the game. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed playing it. I liked it the more I played it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think the Old West theme, like, I don't really think that draws people in all that much, really.
I mean, I don't know. I was less interested in the Old West theme and more interested in the building part of it. But the building of the buildings is honestly a fairly small part of the game.
Well, there is that whole thing with the placement puzzle stuff, which I like.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
All right. Well, you heard it here, folks. This is sort of a mini preview of things you can expect to see in our written review in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, maybe. So, I don't know. Weird Giraffe makes awesome games. And this one just, like, really, it's like the plane landed at the right airport, but not on the right runway.
Okay.
That's where I'm at.
All right.
Does that make sense?
I think so.
All right. Next game is a game that always lands on the right runway, and that is Tussie Mussie.
We actually played this game at a restaurant.
Oh, man. We went out to a restaurant, and there were two people, and we had a conversation and played a game and held hands and looked at each other and didn't have to fight with kids.
And just ate the food that we wanted rather than having to negotiate
the children's leftovers. I mean, anyway, whatever. Yeah. So we played Tussie Mussie. It was wonderful. We got to play. I actually beat you, which basically never happened.
You say that. You literally beat me 40% of the time.
That is less than half. That means it is less common than me being. All right, fine. Anyway, let's talk about the next game on the list, shall we?
Okay. So another card game
mm-hmm.
that feels kind of classic in a similar way to Tussie Mussie, has a little bit of a classic feel to it, other than the fact that you're reading all the cards all the time.
So we went back and forth about this because I felt like you could play this game with a deck of cards, but you couldn't play this game with a deck of cards. The distribution doesn't work, but it really felt like it felt more like kind of that classic card game style of game.
Well, let's
than
not
I expected.
Leave the poor people in suspense. The game is Enchanted Plumes.
From Calliope Games.
I was not expecting to enjoy this game as much as I did, especially when I had heard somebody else say it felt like a classic card game, too. And honestly, for me, that's kind of like I played a lot of those because I had nothing else to play back in the day.
Well, and, you know, while we were playing this game, first of all, you and I took very different strategies in this game. And I misplayed it. Well, it's because I misplayed it. I made a mistake. I forgot the way the rules work. It's fine. But while we were playing, I didn't think you liked it. I thought we were going to finish and you were going to be like, eh. And then like 10 minutes later, you're like, man, I really want to play that game again. I was like, what?
I want to play it again. Yes. Yeah. So in Enchanted Plumes, you are basically playing the role of male peacocks all competing for the same peahen. That's the theme. That's as far as the theme goes. But you're building these giant tails of plumage so you can be the most impressive. But the idea here is it's really a numbers puzzle that you're laying out, you know, a top row and then making an inverted pyramid, you know, with multiple rows, going down to a single card, which does get scored, but thematically you turn it over and you see the little peacock body.
Right.
So it shows.
Well, it's the head. It's like the head.
It's like the head and the neck. Mm-hmm. So it shows that your peacock is finished.
So the interesting thing about this game is, so there's, gosh, like 10 or 11 or 12 different colors of feathers.
I think there's only 8.
There's more, got to be more than 8.
It feels like a lot.
It feels like a lot. And what you do, you can create as many peacocks as you want in front of you, but the first row of feathers that you put down are worth negative points. So,
so you
as you establish...
Zeros and your ones there.
Yeah, you want your zeros and your ones there. Those are going to be negative points. And then the second row has to be 3 feathers and the third row has to be 2 feathers. So you're always like losing at least one color as you move your way down, probably. Yeah,
each row has to only use colors that were represented in the row above.
Right, right. And so by the time you get to like close to the bottom, even though you're showing the back of the card, which is the head of the peacock or whatever, it's got to be one of those two colors. So as you get further and further down, you want higher... Well, I guess it doesn't really matter once you get past the first row, but you are limiting the colors that are available to you for that peacock while simultaneously winnowing down the number of cards of that color in the deck because you need to play them into your
peacock. Yeah.
And so it's this kind of press your luck kind of thing that, you know, as you get further down.
Well, and you look at it and you're like, well, I can play this one and it's really valuable. But then I'm going to finish locking off this row. And what if the next card I get is the color I didn't end up using?
Right.
Now I can't use it in, you know, the next row down in the peak.
Right. And so the rule that I screwed up was that you can put multiple feathers of the same color in a row.
Yes, you can. And you acted as if you couldn't.
And I made them all unique every time. I mean, unique, but still of the row above it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could have finished, I made a giant peacock. It was like 6 feathers at the top and I got it all the way down and I had to put like one more onto it to finish it. And then you went out and finished the game.
Yeah.
And I was like, because if you finish a peacock, like you score the whole thing, but if you finish a peacock, you also get a point for every single feather you've used, including the top row.
Yeah. Including the negative one.
So, I mean, you do the math, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That is 21 cards.
Yeah.
That's a lot of points in this game. So anyway, so there was something about like the top row being negative and the rest of them being positive and the cards are all these very elegant feathers. And it just like there was something about it that made it feel like a classic card game.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you on that. It definitely felt classic, but in all the good ways.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it was pretty. The art was pretty, but it was like classic pretty. It wasn't like, wow, this is like rich and vibrant and blah, blah, blah. No, it wasn't like Mr. Cuddington art. It was like Beth Sobel art.
It's a peacock and you have peacock feathers.
Yep.
And they're pretty, but they're just.
And when you win at this game, you get to strut around the house singing Katy Perry.
You sure about that?
You don't get to sing peacock?
I mean, that's not what I did when I won.
Well, it's because we were in someone else's house. Anyway. All right, we have one more game on the list. This is a game that we picked up a couple of months ago and just it's been sitting on our shelf of opportunity.
Yeah.
This is a game we actually bought, so that's probably why we hadn't played it, because we had review obligations for all these other games. And that was God's Love Dinosaurs. So this is a game that we talked about with Jeremy Howard. He was on the show.
It is exactly what he
it
promised.
Really, really is. It's so funny. But even though it's exactly what he described to us, like I didn't really know what we were getting from the game other than the fact that a lot of people said it was really good.
Yeah, so it's this interesting, you know, you're doing tile laying, and with the tile laying, you get animals or sometimes move animals around in your little world.
Biome.
Terrain, I don't know.
Yes.
And you've got prey and predators and dinosaurs. And so the prey just like, oh, hey, the prey have activated. They can all multiply themselves if you have enough room. But when the predators activate, every single predator needs to move in a specific way, and they have to eat some prey, otherwise they die. But if they eat more than one prey in their movement pattern, then they reproduce. And that's pretty cool, because when the dinosaurs activate, the dinosaurs want to eat everything. But the dinosaurs will lay eggs if they eat predators. And eggs are the vehicle for points in this game.
Yeah, eggs are points.
Eggs are points that also allow you to sometimes hatch some additional dinosaurs.
Correct, because dinosaurs are also points.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it. So the prey doesn't really move. It just reproduces.
It just reproduces.
The predators, there's tigers and eagles?
Yeah.
Yeah. And eagles move in a straight line. Tigers just move two.
Yeah.
And then there's the dinosaurs, which move five spaces any way you want to, but they have to end their movement on a mountain.
Yes. And they're allowed to backtrack or loop or whatever.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Even a tiger is able to do that if it wants to. Like, I don't know why you would. You only get two movement. But
yeah.
So that's pretty much the game. I mean, it moves through a series of rounds. There, you kind of draft these double hexagon
terrain tiles,
and then whatever icon is on it, either prey or predator, you get those icons. And then if the column...
When you empty out a column, then the animal represented by that column activates. And you do the thing. The prey multiply, the predators move and eat and whatever. And then there's a little dinosaur tracker thing. And when you empty out the column that the dinosaur is currently below, the dinosaurs activate. The other key here is that after moving your dinosaurs around and eating things and hatching eggs and whatever, that is the only time you refill the board full of all of these double hexagons. So because you and I were learning, we pretty much every time like saved the dinosaur until everything else was gone.
Right.
No other choices left.
Yeah, there were a few times when I was strategically drafting tiles to activate things that wouldn't really help you that much, but I don't think we ever were doing anything strategic with the activation of the dinosaur.
Of the dinosaur itself, yeah.
Right, because we were always just kind of trying to maximize our own points.
Right. But I could see us possibly playing a little bit more that way in the future.
A little bit more cutthroat. This is definitely a game where you could be cutthroat if you wanted to be.
But where you also don't have to be.
Right.
So, like, for our kids who are fine with battling, but not really, they don't really think about going after each other and hate drafting and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, they haven't gotten a chance to play it yet, but I think they'll enjoy it when they do.
I think so. Yep. So, that is Gods Love Dinosaurs from Pandasaurus. And that is the end of what we've been playing.
You and I played the same number of games this week.
Weird.
Wonder
how
that
happened. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to welcome our new members to the Family Gamers community. And then we're going to talk about our topic.
Honey, I shrunk the games.
What?
So before we talk about shrinking games down for whatever reason.
For good or evil.
Let's welcome a couple of new members to the Family Gamers community.
Absolutely. Let's start with welcoming Anthony Vasquez. Welcome to the community.
Welcome to Bat Shiva.
Mm-hmm. Adele Frank.
Sky Helen Hackett.
And Christopher Vincent, thanks so much for joining the community. We hope that you are finding some good resources out there. I know there's been some chatter. So feel free to say hello to our newest members of the community.
All right, on to our topic. Why would a publisher ever want to shrink a game down or ask a designer, can we make this a faster game?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of really, really good reasons. One of them is that a lot of games require three or four players to really have the full game experience. And so I think the first time we really saw this was with like Lookout Spiel and Z-Man when they were really shrinking down some of their like huge epic games like Agricola into two-player versions, for example.
Sure.
But also you find games where a game's kind of long and, you know, our attention spans are getting shorter. And so sometimes companies want to shorten the game experience, but they want to leverage an existing brand, something that has been, you know, well known and maybe it's a well-regarded gateway game and they want to make it a little bit smaller, a little bit more compact. Or maybe there's a game that came out that a lot of people really like, but it also gets some reasonable criticism for being too long. And so another alternative is out there. I think of, you know, Terraforming Mars and Ares Expedition, which just came out. Mm-hmm. Terraforming Mars is technically a card game, but it's like a board card game.
Yeah.
And Ares Expedition is the whole same game, but like cut down to like 40 minutes.
All right.
So, you know, I mean, that people weren't knocking Terraforming Mars for being a too long of a game because the people who bought the game wanted that experience.
Right.
But in order to appeal to another demographic, they wanted to make a shorter version. So there's lots of reasons.
And sometimes it's to make something more beginner friendly as well. Mm-hmm. Like,
absolutely.
I know lots of people love Gloomhaven, but that's a lot of game. It's too much for me. But people have been really, really happy with Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion, which is a smaller, less involved game and holds your hand a little bit more. And then people can move on from that if they want to, or they can stick with that if they want to.
Well, and something like Jaws of the Lion also, like, pretty much mechanically, it's the same game.
Right.
But you're getting into that game for $50, mm-hmm. not $150. Mm-hmm. And so the cost is going to be a big part of that as well. I mean, we're even seeing that with like Downforce coming to Target with a slightly less expensive version or model. Fireball Island also coming to Target with a slightly, you know, smaller, a little bit more mass market presentation, right?
So we're not really going to talk about games like that where things have just been made smaller without touching the mechanics at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first example we promised we were going to talk about it first is Parks and Trails.
Yeah, so Parks is this gorgeous game. It's relatively light, although there's a fair bit of reading and planning skills involved. So you're probably not going to want to play it with kids younger than 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gorgeous and it's just a little long if you're playing it with beginners or kids.
Well, let's be blunt. I mean, the production quality on the game is very high.
Yes.
It's an excellent game. It's got wonderful trays. The organization is fantastic. It's also a $50 game.
Yeah.
It's a little on the expensive side for a game you're going to pick up at Target. But Trails is $25. And honestly, like, for what you get in the Trails box, it's still a little bit expensive, but it's because the production value still remains high.
Yeah, so the big thing I noticed right away, Trails versus Parks, is that Trails has these three resource types, stones, leaves, and acorns. And in Parks, I would expect those to be some kind of...
Well, you don't have to expect. They are. They're like, I mean, cut. Like the sun is like
cut
and the teardrops and whatever.
And in Trails, they are literally just wooden cubes.
And that's fine.
That's fine.
Totally fine.
Especially because in Trails, you're doing a lot more of taking and putting back and taking and putting back, mm-hmm. trading these resources back and forth a lot of times. So especially because that, cubes are fine because they're not sitting in front of you for very long.
Right, right. So one of the things that makes Trails a much more simple version than Parks is the fact that, first of all, the game flows way faster.
Mm-hmm.
The currency management is much more simple. Even though you're trading things a lot more, there's less currency modifier. So like there's you can't buy that much equipment that'll make things cheaper. There's some of that, but there's not much of it.
There's only three resources to keep track of instead of four plus a wild,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I know that's like, that's not a huge difference. It's not a huge difference, but it's enough of a difference.
Right.
And like you said, you're not doing equipment and stuff. That is a big thing I noticed is you're not buying equipment at all, really.
Yeah, you do get badges which have some of the same kind of stuff, but it's not anywhere near the level at which it is in Parks. In Parks, you're essentially managing a tableau.
Yeah.
And you do that a little bit with Trails, but it's, you know what it is? It's just, it's a smaller experience that is extremely similar. That being said, I do not think, and this is going to be different for some other games we'll talk about later, I do not think that having trails means that we don't have to have parks. I mean, you don't have to have anything, but like, I do think they are different enough experiences that I want to keep both of them.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In this case,
I can very easily see us bringing trails to a restaurant or to someone's...
A restaurant.
Not a great restaurant game, but it doesn't take up a ton of space, and it's done in about 20 minutes.
Yes, it's much faster. So, it's a good travel game.
So, not necessarily a restaurant, but a compact space and a short period of time. That is never, ever, ever going to happen with parks.
Sure. All right, so let's talk about another game. Let's talk about Ticket to Ride and Ticket to Ride New York or Ticket to Ride London, if you want to compare it to Ticket to Ride Europe.
So there are so many Ticket to Rides.
There are a bajillion,
so
yes.
Most versions of Ticket to Ride, expansions for Ticket to Ride, whatever, use this format, and you can expect anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, depending on whatever kind of complexity gets added in with expansions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Ticket to Ride New York and Ticket to Ride London take the whole same idea of the placing your trains and completing your routes and the back and forth with getting your tickets and all of that, and they just make every single piece of it a little bit shorter.
A lot of bit shorter.
The map is smaller. The routes are smaller. You're still going to be picking up or putting down the same number of trains, or in this case, I guess, taxi cars.
Mm-hmm.
So that part's the same, but all the rest of the framework has just shrunk.
I think even that part is smaller. Like, I don't think there's too many 6 taxi routes in Ticket to Ride New York.
Sure.
But the point here is that they've taken the Ticket to Ride experience and they have shrunk it down. And you can get Ticket to Ride New York on sale, well, on super sale for like $10.
But even like normally you're looking at maybe 20?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a $20 game. And this is a good example of a game where we decided that, quite honestly, the Ticket to Ride New York experience is good enough to scratch the Ticket to Ride itch. And we actually have moved on from our copy of Ticket to Ride, which when I told some of my friends, they were completely shocked.
They were flabbergasted.
They were, in fact, flabbergasted.
So part of this also comes that as gamers, we know that it's not like we're never going to play Ticket to Ride again. We just don't need our own copy. There will always be other copies around.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, within our own family and our own home, Ticket to Ride New York is enough.
Right. As, you know, not epic super fans of Ticket to Ride, the New York experience was so close to the full experience that it was sufficient.
While taking half the time.
Well, taking less than half the time, I think.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things I wanted to draw out about Trails and Parks is, I mean, those games are different enough, even though they are very clearly the same DNA, that it's worth it to have both of them. And I don't feel that way about Ticket to Ride and Ticket to Ride New York.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to something that's more along the lines of the Trails and Parks, and which we've talked about before on the podcast. And that is Monopoly Deal.
I actually feel differently about Monopoly Deal than I do about either of these other two games.
So I get that. But Monopoly Deal takes the DNA from Monopoly and distills it down to a card game, which takes at most 20 minutes. Sometimes it is over a lot faster than that.
So I don't even want to own Monopoly. And I don't mind owning Monopoly Deal.
Right. So this is a case where Monopoly Deal and Monopoly are like Trails and Parks in that they have the same DNA and they scratch some of the same itches there, but they are definitely different games. In this case, they are different enough that we say we like Monopoly Deal and we don't particularly like Monopoly.
Yeah, I mean, I have a respect for Monopoly. Like, a lot of people, you know, poo-poo Monopoly the way we poo-poo Candyland. I have respect for Monopoly because it is such a classic game. Like, it...
There's a lot of history there.
There is a ton of history there. But it just, I don't...
It's just not fun for us to play.
Yeah, no, not really, no.
But you can respect it and say, it's just not fun for me to play.
Mm-hmm.
Monopoly Deal takes the parts that we enjoy the most, the collecting of the sets of properties and the occasionally being able to stick it to the other players, and that becomes the whole game. There's no roll and move. And on top of that, it's now super portable. And because it plays so quickly, you really can take it and play it pretty much anywhere.
Yep, absolutely. So from here, what I want to do is I want to pivot a little bit.
Okay.
And we're going to look at 3 games that were shrunk down from larger games to become 2-player games. Unlike the games that we just talked about, where they were really shrunk down to provide a less expensive experience, or I'm sorry, a more cost-effective experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a shorter experience, or whatever it might be.
More beginner-friendly. Or
maybe even in the case of certain games, they go from the hobby game to something that they can actually sell at a mass market store or whatever mm-hmm. it might be. These are games where they've taken a larger game and said, you know what? I want a refined experience that still draws from the same intellectual property or whatever it might be, but it's specifically designed for two players.
So this is shrinking it down in a different way. This is shrinking down the player count and saying, you know, maybe this game is okay at two players and we want to make it really great at two players.
And so the key here is, like, the goal of shrinking down the other ones was to shrink down the experience. The goal here is to shrink down the player count. And so in some of these games, the general mechanisms of the game might stay the same, but the structure and the framework of the game have actually changed.
Yes. But they are still recognizably the same game DNA.
Right. Right.
So the first one of these that we're going to look at is King Domino Duel.
Right. So I think all of these two-player games we like, but in some of these cases, we might not like it as much as the original. So the OG King Domino, it was a...
Love it.
I mean, fantastic game. It was a Spiel des Jahres winner. I mean, it's excellent. It is an evergreen title. It's going to be around forever. Blue Orange can ride that pony as long as they want to.
And probably the first game tonight that we've talked about, the original King Domino is completely kid-friendly. There is no reading... There is multiplication and math, but it's the kind of multiplication that you can walk your kids through and will probably help them understand how multiplication actually works a lot better.
Right.
And then there's King Domino Duel.
Which is a roll and write, die-based thing that, like...
It has dice drafting, and
the puzzles are more complicated in this two-player game.
Dominoes out of the dice.
It's weird.
It's a good game, but honestly, it makes... King Domino more complicated.
A lot, like, it's a fine game and it makes everything more complicated. The game is harder to understand, it's harder to play, it's harder to be successful at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's enjoyable, but honestly, for us, we looked at it and we're like, it's not really the game for us. I would much rather just play King Domino.
Right. Now, the one thing I will say about this game, which is not true about the next one that we're going to talk about, is this shrunken down experience plays better like on a date.
King Domino Duel.
King Domino Duel.
Sure. And that's in large part because they made it a roll and write.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having a box full of dominoes, you have four dice and three sheets of paper for the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So this is a case where shrinking down the experience really didn't work for us. And, you know, sometimes these things are going to just be the people that are involved, right? So this might work for other people. You know, we're not saying, like, do not buy King Domino Duel. We're just saying that because of the way that we do stuff and the fact that we have so many other games, like the one thing that it really works for as a date game, we have so many other options for that.
Well,
it just...
And for what it's worth, I would say King Domino Duel is one of those, if you think King Domino is okay, but wish there was more puzzle there, then King Domino Duel is worth looking into because it is just more stuff... In less space.
I mean, I guess so, but like, I just don't feel like if that's what you're going for, I don't think King Domino is the IP that you're going to be sticking with.
I mean,
you know
maybe.
What I mean? Like, I don't feel like there was anything about that game that made it like so truly like, oh, it must be a King Domino game. Yes. Sure. I mean, I could name a few Roll and Write that I like better than King Domino Duel.
Gee, I wonder what those might be.
So anyway, so on the flip side, in many ways, we have Seven Wonders Duel.
So I've only played this a little bit, but I've played Seven Wonders a lot, thanks to Board Game Arena.
Well, so, okay, first of all, Seven Wonders Duel is on Board Game Arena. We can play it if you want to.
We should do
but
that
we also
too.
Have the physical version, and it's a two-player game, so like, you know, whatever. So the interesting thing about Seven Wonders Duel is that they've completely changed the core drafting process of the game.
Well, and that's because a two-player drafting game doesn't generally work really well.
Not in the same way,
especially
right.
with cards.
Right, so... Classic Seven Wonders has a similar hand drafting mechanism, kind of like a Sushi Go or something like that, but every single card can be used in multiple ways.
Yeah, and you really need to have a minimum of three players to play Seven Wonders.
You do. Seven Wonders Duel, because of the fact that you only have two players, there's three rounds, and you set up this kind of face-up, face-down... Pyramid, like solitaire,
like
stack
like pyramid
thing. Well, every one of them is different. Like one of them is a open triangle, one of them is a closing triangle, and then there's like a rhombus-shaped thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're drafting off of this thing, and you know, some of the strategy is, do you want to allow stuff to get flipped over because now there isn't something on top of it? Do you want to expose other things? You know, you're really trying strategically to prevent things that you don't want to be available to the other player to be available to the other player.
Which is something you do in the card drafting of Seven Wonders, but again, that sort of thing doesn't normally work in a two-player card drafting game. So this idea with the pyramid-type shapes and the face-up, face-down brings that same sort of decision-making in to a two-player game, which is awesome.
And instead of the way the military works in Seven Wonders, where it affects the players to your left and to your right, or you have the players to your left and to your right affect you.
You just compare the number. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, well, because in a two-player game, you're only have
only
one other
have the
player,
one opponent,
right?
Yeah.
So instead, they sort of took that and said, well, if it's always going to be the other person that you're kind of vying for, they created a military track. And now you're moving a token up and down
back
this
and
balance track for military, which is another brilliant thing. Honestly, Seven Wonders Duel is so much better than Seven Wonders. First of all, it's just, Seven Wonders is a big game. I mean, you can play it fast if everybody, like, it's the kind of drafting game where one player can really, really slow everything down.
Oh, yeah.
And so if everybody is like all in on Seven Wonders, then yeah, you can absolutely burn through that game super fast. But that's probably not happening.
Yeah, I will say, although I've played it a lot, I think I like it as a turn-based game on Board Game Arena, where I can take my turn, I can walk away, I can come back like a day later and be like, oh, okay, it's time for another turn.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would get very frustrated with it with a group of people in person, especially a larger group, because,
right.
Yeah, you have to wait until everybody is ready before you can pass the cards and take the next turn.
Yeah, I think Seven Wonders says it's 3 to 7 players.
It is.
And that's a lot of players.
Well, it's fitting with the theme.
I mean, I get it. I know. But yeah, so this is a case where the smaller box game, like, it's still not really suitable for travel or restaurant play or anything like that. It just doesn't really work because all
smaller means it only takes up half the table.
Right. But the game also, I think, you know, if both people know what they're doing, the game can go faster. I think it's absolutely a smaller box on your shelf.
Yeah.
I just think it's a better put together game.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So we've gone through two where we have very strong feelings. We're going to go to one that's a little bit less strong feelings on.
And then we're going to wrap up the show with this one.
Sure.
Okay.
So I will introduce this by saying, I love the game Imhotep. You have that physical aspect. You actually build stuff. You sail the boats around. And I think the decisions are really interesting in the game, where everything you do is affecting other people.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that they do is affecting you.
Yep.
Then there's Imhotep the Duel. I can look at this and objectively say it is a great game, and it takes the entire feeling of Imhotep and flips it on its head so that you have the same kinds of decisions, except the decisions work in a completely different way.
Yes, they do.
I personally prefer Imhotep, but this is not one where I'm like, Imhotep is objectively the better game. It's just one that I like better.
So I agree with you that I enjoy playing Imhotep at two players more than I enjoy playing Imhotep the Duel. And the thing, here's the thing. There are so many pieces in Imhotep the Duel. Like, there's so many different cardboard
tiles,
chits. And like, it doesn't feel like there's anything that's beneficial about it being a smaller experience at all.
Okay.
At all. Because there's a ton of setup. You have to line up all the things and you have to make the piles and slide the boats in on the square thing.
Mm-hmm,
and it's... Mm-hmm. There's just a lot there, and it's like, honestly,
there's probably less setup.
There's probably less setup in the big box game, and you have the flexibility of going to 3 or 4 players if you want to. I couldn't find a good reason to keep Imhotep the Duel, because Imhotep just gave us everything that we wanted anyway.
But that said, like, this is not one where I'm going to be like, oh, like, King Domino Duel is just, it doesn't have the things I love from King Domino. Imhotep the Duel has all the things I like from Imhotep, except for the actual physical building with the blocks.
Mm.
And it really is just that the actual physical building with the blocks is just enough of a pull, and not having to read anything. There's a lot more reading in the duel that I like traditional Imhotep better, even at two players. But I feel like it's a much smaller difference.
I mean, that's fine. I just feel like even if they were equal, you get more in the Imhotep box.
I agree.
And it has more that you can do. And honestly, like, we talk about the fact that we're trying to purge games all the time. So if I can get out of one game what I'm trying to get out of two games, I'm going to go with the one game.
Going to go with the one game, even though it's the bigger box.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
I think we should also mention again, we said very quickly at the beginning of the show, games like All Creatures Big and Small, which is the two-player Agricola,
mm-hmm.
does all of the things we were talking about earlier of taking a big hobby board game, making it way more accessible, and also making it two players in the process. I'm kind of hoping we see more of that with some of these big hobby games. I think we did see it with like Gloomhaven, Jaws of the Lion, and the Terraforming Mars
Ares Expedition. Yep.
And I hope we keep seeing that, finding more ways to bring some of these big box, kind of complicated hobby board games down to something that's way more accessible, both cheaper, faster, simpler, all the things. And then if you want to move up to the big game, go for it.
Rio Grande, you hear it. I want a smaller version of Zulkin, please, so I can play it with my wife. That's what I want for Christmas.
Simpler.
Please. Please. But, okay, so what does all this mean, Basil? The point to this is to say, look, there is no hard and fast rule about how a smaller game is going to be better or worse, or it appeals to this kind of person or that kind of person. And what we really wanted to do was run the gamut and kind of talk about all sorts of different examples, some that worked really well and some that didn't work really well, to really show you that this is not a hard and fast thing. Like, if you try a smaller version of something and you're like, you know what, this does not work for me, do not write off all smaller versions of games.
Yeah, this is not a blanket statement. Some work really well and some don't. And some of that is going to depend on your personal experience.
100%. And you know, you may try a two-player game, even though you don't normally like them, and be genuinely shocked. Voltage. Is a good example of that. Like, we've talked about it a couple times. Like, that was a game that came from Mattel, and we were like, I'll try it out. And we're like, holy cow, this is really good.
Yeah.
And we've played two-player games like King Domino Duel, where we're like, this is coming from, you know, a great studio, and it's a great IP, and it's been developed by the same, you know, great designers.
And it just
fell flat for us, you know? So it really, really, really does depend on the game, and it depends on what kind of thing you're dealing with. I'll give you another example of a smaller game that really worked well for us. Puerto Rico to San Juan.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Right? Puerto Rico is a great game, very big game. There's obviously the kind of the problem with your workers on your plantation and that whole thing.
Your colonists are not colonists. They're slaves.
Yeah, that's not good. San Juan gets rid of all that, right? So there's definitely opportunities to find the right games to fit. And it's going to be dependent on the individual games. And so the thing I really want to stress here is don't write them off because you had a bad experience or two, because there's good ones and there's bad ones.
I'm going to take it a step further and say you should definitely try smaller versions of games that you already like. You might find yourself pleasantly surprised and say, you know what? I think I like this one better, like we did with Ticket to Ride New York.
Mm-hmm. Like we did with Seven Wonders Duel.
All
right. And that's it. That's a show. I think it's time to wrap it up. So if you have had this kind of experience where you've played a smaller game and you've been like, man, this is good, like, I would love to hear about it. There's lots of different ways that you can reach out to us on all of the social media. You can find us
at Family Gamers AA. We would love to talk about this and any other family gaming adjacent topic in our Facebook community.
That's right. The easiest way to go there is to go to thefamilygamers.com/community. You can head over there now, anytime. Welcome our new members if you're already in the community. And if you're not in the community, you should join.
If you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can always email us.
Andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
Anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
Don't forget, you can also check out our new Family Gamers and Play Games with Your Kids merchandise, t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, etc. at thefamilygamers.com/merch.
We're almost getting into hoodie weather again. Someday.
I know.
Someday soon.
I know. Every once in a while, like maybe in the mornings when we have the windows open and the birds are chirping and it's a little chilly outside and we're having coffee. No rain.
Please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. Tell your friends about it. Even better, leave us a review. Stars are good. Words are better.
That's true.
At Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you subscribe.
Yep. You can find us on Amazon Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or Spotify.
The Family Gamers is sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers and learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points.
All right, Anitra. Well, there's nobody upstairs, so I think we should grab one of these two-player games and go have fun.
Sounds good to me. Until next week,
play games with your kids.